Jacob, you okay?
Oh, yeah.
I like when you get that attitude, that smuggy look on your face.
We'll see how this goes. That's what he's thinking.
Is that what he's thinking?
All right, the death penalty has sort of been on hold ever since Governor Inslee took over in Olympia. He's basically said, we're going to freeze it all. We're just going to not do anything. So now they have some legislation moving through saying, you know, we're going to make this permanent.
Yeah, because not only that, first it was with Inslee a few years ago, and then the Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional because it was unfairly applied. It wasn't equally applied. So it has been unconstitutional, according to this our Supreme Court, to have the death penalty unless you fixed up a bunch of things that were wrong with it, that established it to be inequitable. Mm-hmm. Those things haven't come to pass, but the legislature has now. Reuven Carlisle, a Democrat from Seattle, has proposed that we just do away with it. We catch up with a bunch of the other states in this country and do away with it all in all. And it has bipartisan support. This does not break down. In fact, it's one of the rare cases, I think, where the two of us both agree.
Why, where are you on this? Because I might just want to disagree just for fun.
Okay. So this is one of the things. I campaigned against the death penalty. This is like when I was in college back in the 70s against this. So I've been opposed to the death penalty forever and a day, it feels like. And you've come on, and we've had this discussion.
I've come on back and forth on
and
it.
You've, okay, that's fine. And it makes for better discussion if we're not on the
same
side.
No, only because I don't necessarily think that it stops
the grief or the grieving.
There's two.
Or the, yeah.
I don't think it stops the crime.
Crime, yes. Okay.
And I don't think it stops the grieving.
It's
from
not
the science that I've read, from the people that have stood there, divided, simply separated by a piece of glass, and watching somebody die.
Yeah.
Later on, they said, I thought I would feel better, and I don't.
It does not bring them peace, and it does not act as a deterrent. And those are the two of the biggest arguments. But right now, there is a movement toward getting rid of the death penalty, unlike it was, 30, 40 years ago when I was first wrestling with this issue. But there are still people with strong views about keeping the death penalty, and one of them happens to be somebody in the legislature right now with an uncomfortably close connection to the Green River Killer.
This is, you're speaking of, is Jenny Graham, Representative Jenny Graham, and her mother spoke in favor of keeping it.
I expect you, the legislature, to make this right. My daughter demands it. Murder victims demand justice today. It is about murder victims and the cruel death forced on them. The death penalty saves lives.
If you have seen my anger today, I have no apologies for it. When the people that commit these crimes are the ones that we go out of our way for. Enough is enough.
Okay. And the reason there's tears and emotions is because of their relative was killed by the Green River.
Yeah, the daughter of the first woman and the sister of the representative who was the second speaker there.
Right, and they say they use this as you can use the death penalty as a way of getting information from these accused. So James McMahon from Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs has also argued keeping the death penalty in place. He says,
you haven't yet heard today the name Jamie Bindle, who is a corrections officer at the Monroe Correctional Facility, who was murdered. Raped and murdered by somebody who is already imprisoned with life without the possibility of parole. What shall we do for Jamie Bindle under this bill?
Okay.
Fair enough. That's another argument that somebody who's already in prison for life without possibility of parole, if they commit more crimes, what more can we do to them if that's not an option?
As a former corrections secretary?
Each of us has been up close and personal to what it takes to kill another human being in our custody. Our experience has taught us that no one, not an individual or the state, should end another's life as a function of government.
The bottom line is this is a fallible system. It's run through a system that is necessarily, unfortunately, impacted by human bias and by imperfect information. And as long as that's true, the risk of executing an actually innocent person will always persist.
Okay. I've looked at the numbers that we've executed since like 18-something, rather, since it became a state, 110 people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see the bias in there as far as the race. It's often people point to economics.
Okay.
And so I'm not sure which one they're looking at. But here
4.5 times more likely to be sentenced to death if you're black than if you're a white defendant. That's one of the observations in the Supreme Court ruling.
Here is your Snohomish County prosecutor saying,
while the death penalty may exist in the law books of this state, it doesn't exist for any legal purpose in the 39 county courthouses of this state. No county prosecutor in this state can credibly tell a grieving family that the death penalty is a possibility. And because of that, the death penalty and any potential benefit for it is illusory. To continue to support this wholly unenforceable law, to keep it on the books, is to perpetuate the illusion of its reality and utility to the families of victims now and in the future. This is simply unfair. The death penalty is now, in this state, a castle in the sky.
Okay, so he's saying that the person's sitting there and you say, well, listen, your father got killed by this individual and then we can try to get the death penalty for him.
Mm-hmm. And he says it's not possible because it's too expensive and most counties can't afford it. Maybe the city of Seattle, King County could afford it, but not in the smaller ones. So there's no – that's part of the unequal distribution of this crime as well. Now, here's something – so again
– I'll just point out one thing about as far as the cost. What you have is there's so many appeals come in from nonprofits that don't believe in the death penalty. They basically gum up the works. So it costs so much. They continue appeal after appeal after appeal after appeal. And the cost, they just basically swamp these smaller districts they can't possibly compete against. The money that's pouring in from the nonprofit that's trying to stop the guy from being killed.
And I would object to that because I don't think it's just the money from the nonprofit because you have the right to appeal. You don't need a lot of money just to appeal it. And because it's the ultimate penalty, they want to make sure that they do it right. No one's saying, hey, if you got one jury to find you guilty, you're executed. Mm-hmm. They want to make sure. Society wants to make sure. So you have them, you allow them to go through all the appellate courts, up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court can decide to hear it or not. But that's one of the objections. So here's where I do agree with this woman. She says that she's afraid personally that there's too much focus on providing criminals, as she says, with the tools to get by. Okay, I think that's bitterness speaking because I don't have a problem with tools for a criminal to get by if they're fairly represented. But here's where I do agree with her. And not enough funding for helping victims or their families.
Uh-huh.
I would have no problem if this is, you may have to raise taxes, but if we were more sympathetic financially to these poor families, that on top of everything else, if that would help, if you take the money that you would normally spend to prosecute or not prosecute somebody and in turned around and gave it to the people, the family, the members, at least there would be some kind of recognition about the harm that society has done to the victims' families. I'd be in favor of that.
Society hasn't done it. An individual has taken a gun or a knife.
But our society has allowed for that person to have the freedom to do something like that.
Well, the society leaves everybody the freedom. It's
that's
the
right.
Personal
no, that's what
choice,
I mean.
Right, to do it.
Yes.
But so you want to make them whole by giving them $1 million for the
certainly
loss of
it's
their...
not. You're not making them whole. But as you point out, killing the perpetrator, if the perpetrator is guilty, doesn't make them whole either. But I would be, as she says, there's not enough funding for helping victims or their families.
I don't
know.
This
could be in psychological, treatment, whatever they might need, therapy or straight on cash. It seems to me that I'd be willing to kind of acknowledge. It's amazing to me that horrible things happen in this world, and if they're criminally, that we do not accept punishing the criminals. We don't acknowledge somehow to help the people that were the victims.
Okay, well, I don't know if there is money set aside in the budget.
Oh, not for now. I don't think, or at least not enough. I mean, there are victims advocacy groups that try to do all this kind of stuff. It'd be nice if we as a society, meaning the government, stepped up and said, okay, we acknowledge, the pain that's been inflicted on you, and we will do what we can to help make you heal.
I bet you anything that there is a nonprofit, and if I were to type in survivors of murdered relatives, I'll bet you there are support groups and nonprofit organizations, either religious-based or some other way.
Oh, no, I know there are.
Right?
I know people who have been their family members have been murdered, and there is a support group out there, absolutely.
Okay, good.
I just think, as she says, there's not enough funding for these kinds of groups. I'm in favor of getting them funding.
Okay, I would be in favor of allowing people to donate to nonprofits as opposed to having the government step in, raise taxes, and create another department that really doesn't work.
But donating to nonprofits may not generate as much money as a government.
Yeah.
Mandate.
I saw
mandate.
A quote the other day. Bernie Sanders does not believe in nonprofits. Doesn't like charities.
What's that? I don't know. I don't know.
Somebody's now digging up all the stuff on all the stuff Bernie has said.
Now,
he was at a United Way breakfast fundraiser.
Yeah.
And he got up and said, I don't believe in private charities.
Okay. So I'm going to take a leap here and guess how he can philosophically defend that. Okay. I think that he thinks that if we just assume that the churches of the world or the nonprofits of the world are going to make this society whole, that's not enough. We shouldn't be dumping it on the few that have a conscience. We should make this a societal decision, and that's where the social safety net might come in. That would be my guess.
That's probably it. He'd rather remove the money from the private individual and run it through the government and have them do it as opposed to have the private individual make the choice where the money goes.
Because I think it's 100% commitment. I mean, everyone's contributing, not just
it's taken from them. They don't contribute. It's taken.
Well, no, if you vote on it, it's not a fiat. If we vote to raise our taxes for whatever purposes, you know, that's democracy. Right.
I haven't voted to raise my taxes for Social Security. That's
I know,
but
most of us have.
Oh, okay. I didn't get a choice on that one. All right, let's see. By the way, if you get a chance to hear from Donald Trump, if you follow his Twitter. I don't follow him on Twitter, but so many people do, and those that get upset about it. He was in India, and he tweeted out talking about Sotomayor and Ginsburg. These are the two that are on the Supreme Court. What happened in January, he said, the president said, here's what I want to do. If you are an immigrant to this country and you're coming in here and you appear to be on the dole or will not have the means to take care of yourself, we don't necessarily want you in this country, right?
Yes.
Very similar going back to the 1920s. You had to have at least $15 and speak some part of the language or whatever it was. So he said, we don't want more people coming in that we have to support. It got held up in court and they said, nope, that you can't do that. And then it kicks back up again. I think the second, which court it was, that said, no, that's okay. We're going to let this thing go. And now the Supreme Court rules on it. 5-4 is
that's
the
right.
rule that the president can do this and we can ask immigrants to not become wards of the state.
And you know, I think Trump does a very good job of playing an idiot, but not really being an idiot. But I think in this case, he might actually be an idiot on this case. He's suggesting that the two of the liberal judges recuse themselves from anything Trump-related that comes before the court. Now, that seems like a step too far. Remember, he did not want Sessions to recuse himself as attorney general. He was really upset about that. I don't think he understands what recusal means. But here's the great thing about what he did. He saw a headline on a Laura Ingraham show that said basically that the judge's bias got in the way of the determination. And so he was reacting to a headline when he said, indeed, that Sotomayor, should recuse herself. So when the reporter asked him, well, what exactly did you find inappropriate? He said, the language is so inappropriate. The statement was inappropriate. It was such a terrible statement. Again, keep in mind, this is the kind of guy who says all sorts of things that might be deemed inappropriate.
Yeah.
Trump said, you know what the statement was. So when the reporter summarized
I got all this. A reporter asked Trump what he thinks about it.
This is perfect.
You tweeted about Justice Sotomayor yesterday, saying that she and Justice Ginsburg should recuse themselves from future cases dealing with the administration. What is the basis for your opinion on that?
Well, it's very obvious. I mean, I always thought that, frankly, that Justice Ginsburg should do it because she went wild during the campaign when I was running. I don't know who she was for. Perhaps she was for Hillary Clinton. You can believe it. But she said some things that were obviously very inappropriate. She later sort of apologized. I wouldn't say it was an apology, but she sort of apologized. And then Justice Sotomayor said what she said yesterday. You know very well what she said yesterday. It was a big story. And I just don't know how they can not recuse themselves for anything having to do with Trump or Trump-related. The right thing to do is that. Now, as a Supreme Court justice, is a different standard. But at the same time, I think it's a higher standard in a certain sense.
Okay.
Is that all? They're so biased.
It's the next cut.
It's the next cut. Okay.
What did Sotomayor say that bothered him?
What was inappropriate about the statement? I'm not an attorney, so I can't really look into it.
The statement was, John.
Well, she seemed to criticize the White House for running to the Supreme Court at the drop of a hat to see the
No,
star.
I don't think that was it. Yeah. But I think what she did say is she's trying to shame, the way I look at it, she's trying to shame people with perhaps a different view into voting her way. And that's so inappropriate.
It became clear. Laura Ingraham, you know, the bottom of the screen says, Sotomayor accuses GOP-appointed justices of being biased in favor of Trump. Mm-hmm. That is Laura Ingraham's spin on it. It's not anywhere near what she said, and that's what he's responding to. And so for him to say, when it's repeated back to him, well, actually, she said this. No, that wasn't it. He responds to the headlines. He doesn't even watch the report. He just responds to the headlines. Mm-hmm. I think, once again, he looks
here's
like
what she said, claiming one emergency. Here's what she said, claiming one emergency after another. Government has recently sought stays in an unprecedented number of cases. It's hard to say what is more troubling, she said, pointing to the case at hand, that the government would ask this extraordinary relief seemingly as a matter of course and that the court would grant it. They don't like the emergencies that they keep coming up with.
Yes, because they say it takes away from these decisions that the Supreme Court should be, you know, spending time on because there are all these emergency things that are immediately going up to the Supreme Court.
Right.
That's what their comment is. That's not what Trump said.
Right. No,
there's nothing wrong with that.
He says something and then you have someone that's campaigning for governor that would like to be able to become the governor of, say, the state of Washington. So then he sues Trump and we have California suing. We have Hawaii suing. All of these guys that want to be able to stand up and sue Trump, and then this stuff gets tied up, kicks up to the Supreme Court. They've got all these emergency stuff that continue to keep coming up.
That's right. And she's saying that the Trump administration is taking a lot of this stuff to immediately to the Supreme Court instead of letting it go through the courts.
Or get blocked by the Ninth. You got self-evident. Here we are. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. You can write to us at MyNorthWest.com. Text as well on the State Roofing text line at 989073. And Keel Mortgage and Laura Keel and the rest of the gang over there. Taking good care of you. If you've got any questions about a mortgage, with money being so unbelievably cheap right now, crazy cheap, you can refinance that house and put that money right in your pocket. You'd be surprised how much money you can save. Find out by calling 1-888-778-KIEL. Just don't drop the phone. That'll hurt somebody's ears. All righty, let's see. Paris Mayor. Tom is going to Paris in July, right? Aren't you going to Paris in July?
Sooner than that, John.
When's that, Tom?
April.
April.
April
in Paris.
I guess we should have chosen the same key, but otherwise, we both know the song.
Who do you like who does that?
The song?
Does that song, yeah, April in Paris.
Jack Jones.
Ooh, that would be nice.
Yeah, they're like, how about you, John?
I'm a Tony Bennett. I like Tony Bennett. But who's the Velvet Fogg?
Oh, Mel Torme is my single. He's my favorite greatest pop singer. I like him more than Frank.
You know, I saw Mel Torme in Philadelphia, and I liked Mel Torme until he started showing off by holding notes for a really long time.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like,
And he does a lot of bebop.
Yeah, which I don't need. Yeah. All right? You're a white Jewish guy. Let it go.
He's showing off, though. He knows his stuff.
Need to do that. You're the Velvet Fogg. That should be enough for you.
Yeah, that's right.
And then guess he takes a break. Guess who comes out? Henny Youngman. And Henny Youngman does 20 minutes in Yiddish.
Oh, wow. Who is the audience? You're supposed to know your audience. I hope this was in New York, at least.
It was in Philly.
Wow.
All right, so Tom leaves for Paris in April.
April in Paris.
No, April in Paris.
Yeah.
April in Paris. You find that one. Okay. And they want to turn themselves into a 15-minute city. If you have been to Paris, you've been lucky enough to take in this unbelievably beautiful city, the City of Lights. It is also the city of traffic that just grinds to a halt. You can't get anywhere. You can't enjoy anything. And it is nasty. So they are basically taking a page from urban planners in the United States, which is to make it a 15-minute city.
Yes. So the idea here isn't new with Paris because this happens in Barcelona. They have their super blocks. And they even mention Portland, Oregon as having 20-minute neighborhoods. What they want to do is create a Paris in which you can get anything and everything that you need in your life within a 15-minute bike ride. They allow for not just walking, but bike ride. They wanted to make it a more amenable city for people that live there to get around without having to clog up, you know, with all the cars and the traffic and the taxis and that. And they said they got a big jump on it this last year. There was a transit strike. So they said, hey, everybody, as long as the buses and the subways are down, let's see what can we get done and what can't we get done. Mm-hmm. The philosophy is to take away the car-centric notion that most of us have ever since cars became ubiquitous in the 40s and 50s, I guess. And the whole idea of suburban living is that everything became isolated from each other. You had big box store here. You had big – everything was separate. They said, no, let's make it all sort of in effect self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about Paris is For there are 2.2 million people in Paris, so it's not a small city, but it geographically it's a pretty tight city, and so because of that you can get a lot. And so what they say is they want to try to make sure that within a 15-minute radius you have everything you need. So that means shopping and food and clothes and eateries and doctors and schools and
so what are
churches.
They going to do to impose this type of urban dream?
Well, at this point it's not an imposition, but they have made some anti-car moves. For instance, I don't know if you how many movies you've seen in Paris with cars. They're driving along the Seine. Well, now they've banished cars, so no cars are allowed to drive along the Seine anymore. So they've moved them up and out.
What about Tom Cruise? Can he do it?
Probably.
I think he's
because
allowed.
He's an American rebel.
How,
he can
how did he
break
know
the
all
rules.
Those side streets? Was that Paris that he was doing that crazy?
Yeah, the last
Come
one he was
on.
In. Yeah, it was crazy. He just happened to get lucky, I guess.
Know, yeah. Okay.
But it's a new wave of thinking about city life.
Yeah.
That if we can get there by walking, that would be a richer life for everybody involved.
Now, but I would assume, having been to Paris a couple of times, you can have a life within 15 minutes.
Yeah, no, in fact,
most of those neighborhoods are the same thing like in New York. I remember my friends, I lived in Upper West Side, 94th and Broadway. My friends moved down to the Village, and I said, hey, I'll see you. And they're like, no.
Yeah.
You're dead to us. And I said, how am I dead? Because we're never going to come up here. I said, it's six subway stops.
Yeah.
It's a subway. You're not, you don't have to crawl. And they're like, no, we'll never see you again. And I never saw them again. And then I think they moved for that reason.
Yeah, that's right. Something you said. Well, they do say that Paris already has a leg up and that there's already this kind of, they call it mixing.
Yeah.
So you mix the neighborhood so you have all sorts of things in there. And they say that's because, and they compare it to the city of Melbourne, Paris has been around for millennia. And so they are pre-industrial. Mm-hmm. Their roots of Paris are pre-industrial. And so everything was built to accommodate all these kinds of things.
Right.
Whereas a city like Melbourne, which is invented centuries later, it's spread out and it's much tougher to I think so, a great one of my second favorite city I have is Berlin. And that's like eight times the size of Paris just geographically. It's not the population. It's so spread out. So this is a good example. I also think because Paris is so heavily touristed, tourists don't bring their own cars. And a lot of them don't rent cars. Just like in New York, when you go to New York, you don't bother with that. So maybe this is the wave of the future for big city experiences. I don't think it's going to help if you live out 15, you know, miles outside of Paris.
You're
it's not going to help much.
Yeah, and they always say, oh, the great experience is to ride in a Parisian cab. Not really. Because like, you're in there and you're like trying to speak some French to the guy. Yeah, he doesn't care. Just drop me off here. That's fine.
I think that's true. I'd agree with that.
Cities are getting richer, and that's not necessarily the whole story. This is from the New York Times pointing out where the money's coming from, who's coming in, and what are they doing with it.
The money is in the has always been in the top five cities in the country, New York, L.A., Chicago, San Francisco, and Washington. But they say right now that's not really the case. The rich aren't getting that much richer. The richer cities are in the next group from 11 to like 25 or 26.
Right.
They say if you are already a big city, you've already got all the riches that you have, and you really can't accommodate more people. So you're not going to get bigger and have more money. It's oftentimes one or the other in a few cities. They don't even mention Seattle, but I would assume Seattle would be in that group, that we have room to boom. And so we're getting richer, and we're also getting bigger. But the big cities, the top five metros, have 5% less than they did in about 30 years ago, 21.7% now, and it used to be 26%. So it's just sort of an acknowledgement that, yes, the big complaint is, and it's definitely true, and we see it everywhere, small towns are getting smaller. There are fewer and fewer people living in small towns. And so they are really taking it in the shorts. But it doesn't mean that it's only New York and San Francisco that are getting bigger. There's that big swath of middle towns that are doing just fine.
As people are able to telecommute, and the number of people telecommuting just here in this area has increased in the last couple of years, I think it's up to 6.8%, is you can start to telecommute, and tech allows that more of that lifestyle because it takes less people to actually have to manufacture something as machines will replace. You can live in a place like Boise, not spend a whole lot of money, have a nice lifestyle, sit there in your living room slash house, office, whatever else it is, and telecommute and have the same work done. You're not putting a wrench on a bolt and turning it in the direction that Michael Bloomberg says you need to turn it. You are still making good money and living where you want to live. So whether it is there or down in parts of Oregon as well, that people move down into Southern Oregon, they've got a really nice lifestyle. They go into work maybe once a week and they're able to have a better work-life balance rather than being stuck in some big city.
Yep.
So good for them.
It's the wave of the future. Yeah. To a point.
Did you find it April in Paris, Sean?
Yeah, I sure did.
Which one did you find that you seemed to like the most? Was it The Velvet Fog?
It would be Fitzgerald and Armstrong.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
April in Paris. Chestnuts in blossom.
Get much slower.
Sean doing that.
Holiday table.
Welcome to Cairo Nights.
Under
of course, the movie
the
critic
tree.
Is being critical.
Yeah, of course. But he likes it because it's very soulful.
Absolutely.
But it's too slow.
No, I didn't say that.
I know, John.
What I like about this is I always imagine myself the drummer who just has the little brushes because you hardly have to do anything.
Yeah.
Just listen.
This is a feeling.
There's no drum.
There's no brush. No, he started out.
You're right. He doesn't have to do anything.
Where is he? All right. Okay. Tracy okay. Taylor.
John, we need a drum solo.
It's like the show's produced. It's like there's a melding of commercials and entertainment and information all into one nice little entertaining sort of thing. For you.
Always a good thing when you can't tell the difference between a commercial and a show.
Well, that's like, who used to do that? That was
Paul
Harvey.
Yeah, Paul Harvey, that's right.
Right. And she got herself an Oreck vacuum cleaner. I was like, wow, I had no idea it was a vacuum cleaner spot.
And that's the end of that story.
She's picking up bowling balls in her living room. I'm like, how many bowling balls?
And was to do the commercial we planned on. At the very end, I'll just do a talking head spot.
I'm not only the hair club president, but I'm also a client.
Yes.
Hair club for men, right?
Cy Sperling. I'm only a client. I'm also the president. I'm also a client. Yeah, and then he held up a picture of himself looking really uncomfortable and bald. And this was, you could get a monthly newsletter delivered to your house talking about men's appearance. They're selling you a book and a newsletter. And I think at the end of the thing said, and you know, the newsletter comes discreetly packaged. So nobody has to know that you're learning about growing hair or at least the fact that you're bald.
And now we have people doing commercials. I listen to 710 Cairo a lot, and they're doing a men's shaving kit thing, you know, from above the waist and below. And I go, wow.
Manscaping?
Yes.
That's so over there? Why don't I get that
exactly.
Spot?
I was going to say.
Check
they,
that
they
out.
Beat to
Check
you.
That out, Tom.
You're already scaped.
I got, yeah. You know what? Because I have gray chest hair, and I don't like that. I'm going to look down and see a big thing of gray chest hair.
But you're, the top of your head's whiter
than
a ghost.
I look at this. Look and see that. It's not a ghost. This isn't white.
But that was exactly, yeah. It's Silver Fox or something. What did you call it?
It's either Moonlight on
or
Fresh
Arctic,
Snow
Arctic.
Or Arctic Silver.
Arctic Silver, that's what it is.
Go ahead.
My point is that now people are becoming much more upfront about their hair needs or their hair wants. And this article is talking about the hair apparent move toward things. And they said everything changed in 2017. Who knew? In 2017, the patent for Propecia, basically, the finasteride or for finasteride, you know, expired. And so now you can get a bunch of inexpensive generic versions. And there's also this affordable hair solution, you know, in Rogaine that now people have much cheaper access to it. So they decided, you know, we're going to make a profit off this and we are going to sell this. And the men, the customers are much more open to this, too. Now there's a transparency involved. You're doing.
Do you think anybody was ashamed?
Yes, absolutely.
Seriously.
Of course. You just proved it by saying that it arrived, you know, that it arrived in a brown package.
70s.
Well, it's not that long ago. And until 2017, there wasn't this big push. I never heard about manscaping as a commercial until I heard it today.
Okay.
I think the point here is that now we're becoming much more comfortable with things like cosmetic surgery in the past. And now with the hair loss, it used to be kind of an embarrassment that people were really embarrassed to be bald or be going bald, and apparently it played, at least all the commercials, played to the psychological debilitation of men.
Yeah.
It seemed like somehow an emasculation, and now I think this is a good thing, not a bad thing, that people are much more comfortable to say, you know what, I wish I looked more virile.
I
wish I looked better. Why not, you know, be upfront about it and go for it?
I got Botox one time a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And this girl said to me, well, I go to where I go. So I take her there. And she called ahead and said, well, he's sort of a celebrity. So they had actually had a back door, like a secret door.
See? Shame? embarrassment?
No. I was like, yeah, bring me through the secret to him. And I remember when I was in the room waiting.
Yeah.
Right? I could hear the nurses out front talking. And the ones.
John Curley.
No, they're like, who's the guy they brought through the secret door? Like, if you have to explain why you're coming through the secret door,
you're not that
you
big
don't
a celebrity.
Belong in the secret door. And they're like, that's good, okay, we're going to open the back. I said, no, you know what? Screw it. I don't need the back door. But for a while there, I thought, oh, this is pretty good.
I see. So you liked the benefit.
I did at first. And then when I realized I didn't deserve it. And then people like, you don't deserve the back door. No one knows who the hell you are. You haven't been on TV in 10 years.
But you are not in the least. One of the thrusts of these articles is that
I have no shame. I don't
care.
Are
no longer embarrassed.
No.
You're not embarrassed
Never
by the
embarrassed
fact
by
that
it.
you had a bald spot that you've now covered up.
No.
That you had bad teeth and now have good teeth.
Yes.
Okay.
It never bothered me.
It never bothered you. Okay.
No, Tom, if you get a toupee.
Yeah.
When people go, hey, that's a nice toupee.
Yeah.
Well, you can't say that's a nice toupee. That's basically saying I can tell it's a toupee. You can't put those two words together.
I see.
You should just not know.
But you can say, those are really nice fake teeth.
Well, they're not fake, Tom. They're my own natural. Oh, that's no, that's my
no,
hair.
That's from the back of your head. You have teeth growing in your back of your head? It's a good thing they did the operation.
It's not an operation. It's a treatment.
Oh, that's
oh
right.
My God.
F-U-E. That's right.